You want coffee first? How was your flight?
I'd love some, I said. The flight wasn't bad.
Julia's apartment was crowded with antiques, a peculiar mix of Victorian pieces and Oriental furnishings. There was a huge carved cherry sideboard with a marble top, a black horsehair sofa, an intricate ivory screen, jade figures, a platform rocker, two cinnabar lamps, Persian rugs, a pierglass mirror in a dark mahogany frame, a piano with a fringed shawl across the top, lace curtains, wall hangings of embroidered silk. A big portable television set with a 25-inch screen loomed on the far side of the room, surrounded by family photographs in heavy silver frames. The television set was turned off, its blank gray face oddly compelling in a room so filled with memorabilia. The only sound in the apartment was the steady ticking of a grandfather clock that sounded like someone tapping on formica with a set of drumsticks. I moved out to the kitchen, poured coffee for us both, and carried it back to the living room, the cups rattling slightly in the saucers like the tremor of a minor California earthquake. "Are these family antiques? Some of the pieces are beautiful." Julia smiled, waggling her cane. "I'm the last person alive in my family, so I've inherited all this by default. I was the youngest in a family of 11 children, and my mother said I was fractious. She always swore I'd never get a thing, that I just kept my mouth shut and waited it out. Sure enough, she died. My father died. I had 8 sisters and 2 brothers, and they all died. Little by little, it all drifted down to me, though I hardly have a place to put anything at this point. Eventually, you have to give it all away. You start with a 10-room house, and finally you find yourself stranded in a nursing home with space for 1 night table and a candlestick. Not that I intend to let that happen to me."
"You've got a ways to go yet, anyway, from what I can see."
"Well, I hope so. I'm going to hold out as long as I can, and then I'll lock and bar the door and do myself in, if nature doesn't take me first. I'm hoping I'll die in my bed one night. It's the bed I was born in, and I think it'd be nice to end up there. Have you a large family?"
"No, just me. I was raised by an aunt, but she died 10 years ago."
"Well, then, we're in the same boat. Restful, isn't it?"
"That's one way to put it," I said.
"I came from a family of shriekers and face slappers. They all threw things. Glasses, plates, tables, chairs, anything that came to hand. The air was always filled with flying missiles, objects rocketing from one end of the room to the other with howls on contact. This was mostly girls, you know, but all of us had deadly aim. I had a sister knock me out of my high chair once with a grapefruit thrown like a curveball, oatmeal flying everywhere. Eulalie, her name was. Now that I look back on it, I see we were common as mud, but effective. We all got what we wanted in life, and no one ever accused us of being helpless or faint-hearted. Well, now, let's tackle those bags. If worst comes to worst, we can always hurl them off the balcony. I'm sure they'll open when they hit the pavement down below."
We approached the problem as though it were a code to be broken. Julia's theory, which proved to be correct, was that Elaine would have come up with a combination of numbers she already had in her life somewhere. Her street address, zip code, telephone number, social security, birth date. Each of us chose one group of digits and started to work on separate bags. I hit it the third time around with the last 4 numbers on her social security card. All 4 suitcases were coded with the same number, which simplified the task. We opened them on the living room floor. They were filled with exactly what one would expect: clothing, cosmetics, costume jewelry, shampoo, deodorant, slippers, bathing suit, but packed in a jumble, the way they do in movies when the wife leaves the husband in the middle of a vicious snit. The hangers were still on the hanging clothes, garments folded over and bunched in, with the shoes tossed on top. It looked as if drawers had been turned upside down and emptied into the largest of the bags. Julia had hobbled over to the rocker, and she sat there now, propping herself up with her cane as though she were an unwieldy plant. I sat down on the horsehair sofa, staring at the suitcases. I looked at Julia uneasily.
"I don't like this," I said. "From what I know of Elaine, she was almost compulsively neat. You should have seen the way she left her place. Everything just so clean, tidy, tucked in. Does she strike you as the type who'd pack this way?"
"Not unless she were in a fearful hurry," Julia said.
"Well, actually, she might have been, but I still don't think she'd pack like this."
"What's on your mind? What do you think it means?"
I told her about the double set of plane tickets and the layover in St. Louis and any other facts I thought might pertain. It was nice to have someone to try ideas on. Julia was bright, and she liked to pick at knots the same way I did.
"I'm not convinced she ever got here," I said. We only have Pat Usher's word for it anyway, and neither of us set much store by that. Maybe she got off the plane in St. Louis for some reason. Without her luggage? And you said she left her passport behind, too. So, what could she have done with herself? Well, she did have that lynx coat, I said, which she could have pawned or sold. I had one of those little nagging thoughts on the subject, but I couldn't bring it into focus for the moment. Julia waved dismissively. I don't believe she'd sell her coat, Kinsey. Why would she do that? She has lots of money. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds. She wouldn't need to pawn anything.
I chewed on that one. She was right, of course.
I keep wondering if she's dead. The luggage got here, but maybe she never made it. Maybe she's in a morgue somewhere with a tag on her toe.
You think someone lured her off the plane and killed her?
I wagged my head back and forth, not wholly convinced. I don't know. It's possible. It's also possible she never made the trip at all.
I thought you told me someone saw her get on the plane, the cab driver you talked about.
That wasn't really a positive identification. I mean, a cab driver picks up a fare and the woman claims she's Elaine Bolt. He never saw her before in his life, so who knows? He just takes her word for it, like we all do. How do you know I'm Kinsey Milhone? Because I say I am. Someone might have posed as her just to establish a trail.
What for?
Well, now, that I don't know. We've got a couple of women who might have pulled it off. Her sister Beverly, for one.
And Pat Usher for another, Julia said.
Pat did benefit from Elaine's being off the scene. She gets a rent-free condo in Boca for months.
That's the first time I ever heard of anyone murdered for room and board, she said tartly.
I smiled. I knew we were floundering, but maybe we'd stumble onto something. I could have used a break at that point. Did Pat ever leave that forwarding address she promised?
Julia shook her head. Charmaine says she left one, but it was humbug. She packed and took off the same day you were here, and nobody's seen her since.
Oh, shit, I knew she'd do that.
Well, it wasn't anything you could have prevented, she said charitably.
I leaned my back against the sofa frame, playing mind games. It could have been Beverly, too, you know. Maybe Bev bumped her off in the ladies' room at the St. Louis airport.
Or killed her in Santa Teresa and impersonated her from that point on. Maybe she was the one who packed the bags and took the plane.
Try it the other way, I said. Think about Pat. I mean, what if Pat Usher were a stranger to Elaine, just someone she met on the plane? Maybe they started talking, and Pat realized... I dropped that idea when I saw the expression on Julia's face. It does sound pretty lame, I said.
Oh, well, no harm done in speculating. Maybe Pat knew her in Santa Teresa and followed her from there.
I ran that around in my head. Well, yeah, I guess it could be. Tilly says she heard from Elaine. At least she assumed it was Elaine, by postcard until March. But I guess somebody could have faked that, too. I filled her in on my conversations with Aubrey and Beverly, and right in the middle of it my memory kicked in. One of those wonderful little mental jolts, like a quick electrical shock when a plug's gone bad. Oh, wait. I just remembered something. Elaine got a bill from some furrier here in Boca. What if we could track him down and find out if he's seen the coat? That might give us a lead.
What furrier? We have quite a few.
I'd have to check with Tilly. Can I make a call to California? If we can track down the coat, maybe we can get a line on her. Julia wagged the cane toward the telephone. Within minutes, I'd gotten Tilly on the line and told her what I needed.
Well, you know that bill got stolen along with the rest, but I just got another one. Hold on, and I'll see what it says.
She put the receiver down and went to fetch the mail. She got back on the line.
She's being dunned. It's a second overdue notice from a place called Jacques, $76 for storage and $200 for having the coat recut. Wonder why she'd do that? There's a little happy face drawn by hand. Thanks for your business, followed by a sad face. Hope the delay in payment is just an oversight. A few more bills have come in, too. Let me see what those look like.
I could hear Tilly ripping open envelopes on her end of the line.
Oops! Well, these are all overdue. It looks like she's run up a lot of charges. Let's see. Oh, my. Visa, MasterCard. The last date on these is about 10 days ago, but I guess that was just the end of the billing period. They're asking her not to use her cards until she's paid the balances down.
Does it indicate where she was when the purchases were made? Was she in Florida somewhere?
Yes, it looks like Boca Raton and Miami for the most part, but you can check them yourself when you get back.
Now that I've had the locks changed, they should be safe. Thanks, Tilly. Can you give me the furrier's address? I made a note of it and got directions from Julia. I left her and went back down to the parking lot. The sky was an ominous gray, and thunder rumbled in the distance like movers rolling a piano down a wooden ramp. It was hot and still, the light a harsh white, making the grass turn phosphorescent green. I was hoping I could take care of business before the downpour caught up with me. Jacques was located in the middle of an elegant shopping plaza, shaded with latticework overhead and planted with delicate birches in big pale blue urns. Tiny Italian lights had been threaded through the branches, and in the pre-storm gloom they twinkled like an early Christmas. The storefronts were done in a dove-gray granite, and the pigeons strutting across the pavement looked as if they'd been placed there purely for their decorative effect. Even the sound they made was refined, a low, churring murmur that rode on the morning air like cash being riffled in a merchant's hands. The window display at Jacques had been artfully done. A golden sable coat had been tossed carelessly across a dune of fine white sand against a sky-blue backdrop. Tufts of sea oats were growing on the crest of the sand, and a hermit crab had crossed the surface, leaving a narrow track that looked like an embroidery stitch. It was like a little moment frozen in time. A woman, someone reckless and rich, had come down to the shore, had shrugged aside this luscious fur so that she could plunge naked into the sea, or perhaps she was making love to someone on the far side of the dune. Standing there, I could have sworn I saw the grasses bend in a non-existent wind, and I could almost smell the trail of perfume she'd left in her wake. I pushed the door open and went in. If I'd had money and believed in wearing furry creatures on my back, I'd have laid down thousands in that place. Chapter 20. The interior was done in muted blues, with a glittering chandelier dominating the high-ceilinged space. Chamber music echoed through the room as though there might be a string quartet sawing away somewhere out of sight. Chippendale chairs were arranged in gracious conversational groupings, and massive gilt-edged mirrors lined the walls. The only detail that spoiled an otherwise perfect 18th-century drawing room was the little camera up in one corner monitoring my every move. I wasn't sure why. There wasn't a fur in sight, and the furniture was probably nailed to the floor. I shoved my hands down in my back pockets just to show I knew how to behave myself. I caught sight of my reflection. There I stood in that rococo setting, in faded jeans and a tank top, looking like something deposited in error by a time machine. I flexed, wondering if I should start lifting weights again. The bicep made my right arm look like a snake that had recently eaten something very small, like a wad of socks. Yes. I turned around. The man who stood there looked as out of place as I did. He was huge, maybe 300 pounds, wearing a caftan that made him look like a pop-open tent with a built-in aluminum frame. He was in his 60s with a face that needed to be taken up. His eyelids drooped, and he had a sagging mouth and a big double chin. What was left of his hair had slipped down around his ears. I wasn't certain, but I thought he made a rude noise under his skirt. "I'd like to talk to you about a past due account," I said.
"I got a bookkeeper handles that. She's out.
Someone left a $12,000 lynx coat here to be cleaned and recut. She never paid her bill."
"So?"
This guy didn't have to get by on good looks alone. He was gracious, too. "Is Jacques here?" I asked.
"That's who you're talking to. I'm Jack. Who are you?"
"Kinsey Milhone," I said. I took out a card and handed it to him. "I'm a private investigator from California."
"No fooling," he said.
He stared at the card and then at me. He glanced around suspiciously, like this might be a candid camera gag.
"What do you want with me?"
"I'm looking for information about the woman who brought the coat in."
"You got a subpoena?"
"No."
"You got the money she owes?"
"No."
"Then what are you bothering me for? I don't have time for this. I got work to do."
"Mind if I talk to you while you do it?" He stared at me. His breathing made that wheezing sound that fat people sometimes make.
"Yeah, sure. Why not? Suit yourself."
I followed him into the big cluttered back room, taking in his scent. He smelled like something that spent the winter in a cave. "How long have you been cutting fur?" I asked. He turned and looked at me as if I were speaking in tongues.
"Since I was 10," he said finally. "My father cut fur, and his father before him."
He indicated a stool, and I sat, setting my big canvas handbag at my feet. There was a long work table to my right, with a coarse brown paper pattern laid out on it. The right front portion of a mink coat had been put together, and he was apparently still working on it. The wall on the left was lined with hanging paper patterns, and there were various quite ancient-looking sewing machines to my right. Every available surface was covered with pelts, scraps, unfinished coats, books, magazines, boxes, catalogs. Two dress forms stood side by side, like twins posing self-consciously for a photograph. The place reminded me of a shoe repair shop, all leather smell and machinery and the feel of craftsmanship. He took up the coat and examined it closely, then reached for a cutting device with a nasty curved blade. He glanced up at me. His eyes were the same shade of brown as the mink.
"So, what do you want to know?
You remember the woman?"
"I know the coat. Naturally, I remember the woman who brought it in. Mrs. Bolt, right?"
"That's right. Can you tell me when you saw her last?"
He dropped his gaze back to the fur. He made a cut. He crossed to one of the machines, motioning me to follow. He sat down on a stool and began to sew. I could see now that what had looked at first like an old-fashioned singer was actually a machine especially designed for the stitching of fur.
He lined up the two cut pieces vertically, fur side in, and caught them in the grip of two flat metal discs, like large silver dollars set rim to rim. The machine whipped the leather edges together with an overhand stitch while he deftly tucked the fur out of the way so it wouldn't get caught in the seam. The whole maneuver took about 10 seconds. He spread the seam, smoothing it with his thumb on the back side. There were maybe 60 similar cuts in the leather, a quarter inch apart. I wanted to ask him what he was doing, but I didn't want to distract him.
"She came in March and said she wanted to sell the coat."
"How'd you know it was really hers?"
"Because I asked for some identification and the bill of sale."
The irritable tone was back, but I ignored it.
"Did she say why she was selling it?" "Said she was bored with it. She wanted mink, maybe blonde, so I offered her credit against something in the store, but she said she wanted the cash, so I told her I'd see what I could do. I wasn't that anxious to pay cash for a used coat. Ordinarily, I don't deal in second-hand fur. There's no market for it here, and it's a pain in the ass."
"I take it you made an exception for her."
"Well, yeah, I did. The thing is, this lynx coat was in perfect condition, and my wife's been after me to get her one for years. She's already got 5 coats, but when this one came in, I thought, what the hell? Make the old broad happy. What's it to me? Mrs. Bolt and I haggled, and I finally got the coat for $5,000, which was a good deal for both of us, especially since I got the matching hat. I told her she'd have to pay to have the coat cleaned and recut."
"Why recut?"
"My wife is on the downside of 5 feet. She's 4'11" if you want her exact height, but don't ever tell her I told you that. She considers it some kind of birth defect. You ever notice that? Short women get that way. From the time they're teenagers, they start wearing funny shoes, trying to look like tall people when they're not. Know what she finally did? Learned to roller skate. She said it was the only time she really felt like a real human being. Anyway, I thought I'd give her this lynx. Gorgeous. You know the coat?"
I shook my head. "I've never seen it."
"Hey, come on, you ought to take a look. I've got it right back here. I haven't cut it yet."
He moved toward the rear, and I trotted obediently behind. He opened the massive metal door to his vault. Cold air wafted out as though from a meat locker. There were fur coats hanging on both sides in double racks, sleeves almost touching, like hundreds of women lined up with their backs to us. He moved down the aisle, checking coats as he went, wheezing from the effort. He really needed to lose some weight. His breathing sounded like someone sitting down on a leather couch, and it couldn't connote good health. He took a fur down off the top rack, and we moved back out of the cold storage room, the door shutting behind us with a clang. He held Elaine Bolt's coat up for me to inspect. The lynx was 2 shades, white and gray in a luscious blend, with the pelts arranged so that each panel ended in a tapering point at the hem. He must have guessed from the look on my face that I'd never seen a coat that expensive up close.
"Here, try it on," he said.
I hesitated for a moment, and then eased into the coat. I pulled it around me and looked at myself in the mirror. The coat hung almost to my shins, the shoulders protruding like protection pads for some strange new sport.
"I look like the abominable snowman," I said. "You look great," he said. He looked from me to the image in the mirror. "So we take it in a little bit, shorten the sleeves, or maybe you'd look better in fox if this doesn't suit."
I laughed. "On my income, I think it's high class to have a sweatshirt with a zipper up the front." I took the coat off and handed it to him, getting back to the subject.
"Why'd you pay her for the coat before she paid you? Why not deduct your costs from the 5 grand and give her a check for the balance?" The bookkeeper wanted it the other way. Don't ask me why. Anyhow, it's not going to cost that much to clean the coat, and the alterations I'm doing myself, so what's it to me? I got a good deal. Adele probably bugged her for payment as a matter of course, but I can't get that upset over the whole thing.
While he returned the coat to cold storage, I went over to my bag and took out the Polaroid picture of Elaine and Marty that Tilly Ahlberg had given me. When he came back out, I showed it to him. Is this the woman you dealt with? He glanced at it briefly and gave it back.
Nuh-uh. I never saw either one of those women before in my life, he said.
What did she look like?
How do I know? I only saw her once.
Young, old, short, tall, fat, thin?
Yeah, about like that. She was middle-aged, and she had blondish hair. And she wore a muumuu and chain-smoked. I wouldn't let her come back here because I don't like the smoke around my skins.
What kind of identification did she have?
You know, the usual stuff. Driver's license, check guarantee card, credit cards. You gonna tell me the coat was stolen? Because I don't want to hear it.
I don't think stolen quite covers it, I said. I suspect someone's been borrowing Elaine Bolt's identity. I'm just not sure where she is in the meantime. If I were you, I'd leave the coat intact until we figure out what's going on. My last glimpse of him, he was pulling unhappily at the wattles on his neck, and he didn't offer to accompany me to the door. I went out into the oppressive Florida humidity. The cloud cover felt like a premature twilight, and the first of several big raindrops had begun to splatter against the hot pavement. I scurried to my car, half-ducking as though I could avoid getting wet by shrinking myself to half my size. I thought about Jack's description of the woman who'd called herself Elaine Bolt. He'd seen the snapshot of Elaine, and he'd sworn it wasn't her. It had to be Pat Usher, as nearly as I could tell. I ran back through my encounter with her. Her attitude of wary amusement, the questions about Elaine she'd fielded, the mixture of lies and truth she'd told. Had she simply stepped into someone else's shoes? She'd been staying in Elaine's condominium, but how had she acquired the Lynx coat if not from Elaine? If she was the one running up charges on Elaine's credit cards, she had to be sure somehow that Elaine wouldn't catch her at it. It seemed to me she could only pull that off if she knew Elaine was dead, which had been my suspicion for days now anyway. There might be some other explanation, I supposed, but nothing that tied everything together so neatly. The rain was coming down hard now, the windshield wipers on my rental car flapping back and forth like metronomes, doing little more than smearing the windshield with a thin film of grime. I found a phone booth and placed a credit card call to Jonah at the Santa Teresa PD. The connection was bad, and we could barely hear each other over the static on the line, but I did manage to holler out what I needed, asking him if he'd expedite the request form I'd sent to the DMV in Tallahassee. A driver's license was the one thing Pat Usher would have had to come up with, since Elaine had none. But it wouldn't have been that hard to falsify. All she had to do was apply in Elaine Bolt's name, pass the test, and wait for the license to arrive in the mail. In some states, you could walk out of the Department of Motor Vehicles with license in hand within minutes of taking the test, at least for a renewal. I wasn't sure what the procedure was in Florida. Jonah said he'd put a call through to Tallahassee and get back to me. I expected to be in Santa Teresa again by the next day, so I said I'd call him when I got in. In the meantime, I drove back to the condominium and had a brief chat with Roland Makowski, the building manager, who confirmed what I'd already heard through Julia. Pat Usher had departed, bag and baggage, the same day I'd spoken to her. She'd dutifully left a forwarding address, some motel down near the beach, but when Roland had tried to get in touch, he'd found out it didn't exist. I asked him why he'd wanted to contact her. He said she'd taken a dump in the swimming pool as a parting gesture and then scrawled her name across the concrete in spray paint.
She did what? I asked.
You heard right, he said. She left a turd the size of a Polish sausage floating right in the pool. I had to have the whole thing drained and sanitized, and I got people who still won't go in. That woman is demented, and you know what pissed her off? I told her she couldn't hang her towels over the balcony rail. You should have seen her reaction. She was in such a rage, her eyes rolled back in her head, and she started to pant. She scared the hell out of me. She's sick.
I blinked at him.
She panted?
She was almost foaming at the mouth.
I thought about Tilly's night visitor. I think we better take a look at Elaine's apartment, I said flatly. The stench came at us like a wall the minute the door was opened. The destruction was systematic and complete. There was fecal matter smeared everywhere, and the couch and chairs had been slashed with murderous intent. It was clear that she'd gone about it quietly. Unlike Tilly's apartment, no glass had been broken and no furniture overturned. What she'd done instead was to open all the canned goods and pour the contents on the carpeting. She'd ground in crackers and dried pasta, jams, spices, coffee, vinegar, soups, moldering fruit, adding contributions from her own intestinal tract. The whole sick stew had been sitting there for days, and the Florida heat and humidity had cooked the mess to a boiling foment of fungus and rot. The packages of once frozen meat that she'd torn open and tossed into the thick of it were full of a wiggling life of their own that I didn't care to inspect. Big flies buzzed around malevolently, their glittering fluorescent heads like beacons. Roland was speechless at first, and when I turned, he had tears in his eyes.
"Well, we're never going to get this cleaned up," he said.
"Don't do it yourselves," I said automatically. "Hire someone else. Maybe your insurance will cover it. In the meantime, you better call the cops." He nodded and swallowed hard while he backed out the door so that I was left to search the apartment by myself. I had to be very careful where I put my feet, and I made a little mental note never to chide Pat Usher for anything. As far as I was concerned, she could hang her towels any place she pleased. Chapter 21. With the cops on the way, I didn't have much time. I picked my way through the apartment, gingerly opening drawers with a hanky across my fingertips out of respect for latent prints. I did a superficial run-through and came up with nothing, which didn't surprise me. She'd stripped the place. All of the drawers and closets were empty. She hadn't left so much as a tube of toothpaste behind. By now she could be any place, but I had a feeling I knew where she was. I suspected she'd used the last two flight coupons for a return trip to Santa Teresa. I closed the place up again and went next door to tell Julia what was going on. It was 2:30 in the afternoon, and I had a 4 o'clock plane to catch with almost an hour of driving just to get to the airport. The sky was miraculously clear again, the air smelling damp and sweet, sidewalks steaming. I loaded Elaine's suitcases back in the rental car and took off, promising to call Julia as soon as I learned anything new. This case was going to break for me. I could feel it in my bones. I'd been on it a week now, and I had smoked Pat Usher out of hiding. I wasn't sure what she'd done to Elaine or why, but she was on the run now, and I wasn't far behind. We were circling right back to Santa Teresa, where the whole thing had begun. When I reached the airport in Miami, I returned the rental car and picked up my seat assignment at the TWA counter, checking the four bags through to Santa Teresa. I got on the plane with 6 minutes to spare. I was beginning to feel a low-level anxiety, the sort of sensation you experience when you know you're having major surgery in a week. There was no immediate danger, but my mind kept leaping into the uncertain future with a churning dread. Pat Usher and I were on a collision course, and I wasn't sure I could handle the impact. With the 3-hour time difference, I felt like I got back to California roughly 1 hour after I left Florida, and my body had trouble dealing with that. I had to wait an hour at LAX to catch the short hop to Santa Teresa, but even so it was only 7 in the evening when I got home, toting Elaine's bags with me like a pack horse. It was still light outside, but I was exhausted. I'd never eaten lunch, and all I'd had on the plane were some square things wrapped in cellophane that I was almost too tired to pick open. It was one of those lurching flights with sudden inexplicable drops in altitude that make napping tough. Most of us were too worried about how they'd collect and identify all the body parts once we'd crashed and burned. Some woman behind me had two kids of the whining and screeching sort, and she spent most of the flight having long, ineffectual chats with them about their behavior.
"Kyle, honey, remember Mommy told you she didn't want you to bite Brett because that hurts Brett? Now how would you like it if Mommy bit you?"
I thought a quick chop in the ear would go a long way toward parent effectiveness training, but she never consulted me. At any rate, when I got home, I headed straight for the couch and fell asleep, still in my clothes. Which is why it took me until morning to figure out that somebody had been in my apartment searching discreetly for God knows what. I got up at 8 and did a run, came home, showered and dressed. I sat down at my desk and started to unlock the top drawer. It's a standard-issue office desk with a lock on the top drawer that controls the bank of drawers to the right. Somebody had apparently slipped a knife blade into the lock and jimmied it open. The realization that someone had been there made the nape of my neck feel like I'd just applied an ice pack.
I pushed back from the desk and got up, turning abruptly so that I could survey the room. I checked the front door, but there was no indication that anyone had tampered with the double-key deadbolt. It was possible that someone had made a duplicate of the key, though, and I'd have to have the lock replaced. I've never worried about security, and I don't run around doing tricky things to assure that my domain is inviolate. No talcum powder on the floor near the entranceway, no single strands of hair affixed across the window crack. I resented the fact I was going to have to deal with this break-in, surrendering a sense of safety I'd always taken for granted. I checked the windows, moving carefully around the perimeter of the room. Nothing. I went into the bathroom and examined the window there. Someone had used a glass cutter to make a small square opening just above the lock. Electrical tape had evidently been used to eliminate any sound of breaking glass. Where the strips of tape had been peeled off, I could still see remnants of adhesive. The aluminum screen was skewed in one corner. It had probably been popped out and then put back. The job had been cleverly done, set up in such a way that I might not have discovered it for weeks. The hole was large enough to allow someone to unlock the window, sliding it up to permit ingress and egress. There's a curtain at that window, and with the panels in place, the small hole in the glass wasn't even visible. I went back into the other room and did a thorough search. Nothing seemed to be missing. I could see that someone had eased sly fingers between my folded clothes and the chest of drawers, had deftly gone through the files, leaving everything much as it had been, but with faint disarrangements here and there. I hated it. I hated the cunning and the care with which it had all been done, the satisfaction somebody must have felt at pulling it off. And what was the point? For the life of me, I couldn't see that anything was gone. I didn't own anything of value, and the files themselves were not worth much. Most of the ones I kept at home had been closed out anyway, and my notes on Elaine Bolt were at the office. What else did I have that someone might want? What worried me, too, was the suspicion that this might be Pat Usher's handiwork. Somehow she seemed much more dangerous if, along with savagery, she was also capable of craftiness and stealth. I called a locksmith and made an appointment to have her come out later in the day to change all the locks. I could replace the window glass myself. I did some quick measurements and then headed out to the street. Fortunately, no one had broken into my car, but I didn't like the idea that someone might try that, too. I took my .32 out of the glove compartment and tucked it into the waistband of my jeans at the small of my back. I was going to have to lock it in my office file cabinet and leave it there for the time being. I was relatively certain that my office was secure. Since I'm on the second floor with a balcony right out in plain view, I didn't think anyone would risk a break-in from that vantage point. The building is kept locked at night, and the door from the hallway is solid oak 2 inches thick, with a double-key deadbolt that could only be breached if the lock itself were cored out with a power saw. Still, I was feeling apprehensive when I pulled into the parking lot behind the office, and I ended up taking the back stairs two at a time. I didn't relax until I unlocked the office door and saw for myself that no one had been there. I put the gun away and took out the file on Elaine Bolt. I typed up additional notes, bringing everything up to date. Inwardly, I was still fuming that someone had been in my apartment. I should have called the police and reported it, but I didn't want to stop for that. I tried to concentrate on the matter at hand. I had a lot of unanswered questions, and I wasn't even sure which ones mattered at this point. Why, for instance, had Pat Usher closed up shop so abruptly in Boca after my first trip down there? I had to guess that once she knew I was looking for Elaine, she'd had to scuttle her plans. I was assuming, of course, that she'd headed to Santa Teresa and that it was she who'd broken into Tilly's apartment and stolen that stack of bills. But to what end? The bills had continued to arrive, and if pertinent information might be gleaned from inspecting them, all we had to do was wait for the next batch. Then I had Mike's account of what he saw on the night of his aunt's murder. I still wasn't sure how that fit in, if indeed it did. The fact remained that his estimate of the time of Marty Grice's death differed by 30 minutes from the time her husband and sister-in-law claimed they'd spoken to her. Were Leonard and Lily in cahoots? There was still the minor matter of May Snyder next door, who'd reported the sound of hammering at the Grice's house that night. Horace swore she was deaf and had it all confused with something else, but I wasn't quite willing to write her off like that. When the phone rang, I jumped, snatching up the receiver automatically. It was Jonah. He didn't even bother to identify himself. All he said was, "I've got a response from the DMV in Tallahassee. You want to take a look?" "I'll be right there," I said, and hung up, heading out. Jonah was waiting for me in the small reception area as I came into the police station,
and he walked me through the locked doors to the corridor leading back to missing persons.
"How'd you get the information so fast?" I asked.
He held the gate open for me, and I passed into the bullpen where he had his desk. He smiled faintly.
"That's why cops are so much better at this business than private eyes," he said. "We've got access to information you can't even touch."
"Listen, I was the one who put in the original request. It's public record. I can't get it as fast as you can, but I was on the right track, and you know it."
"Don't get so hot," he said. "I was just ragging you."
"Very cute. Let me see it," I said, holding my hand out. He passed me a computer printout, a magnetic image of a driver's license issued to Elaine Bolt in January, with the Florida condominium address. I stared at the picture of the woman staring back at me, and uttered a quick involuntary, "Ah." I knew the face. It was Pat Usher. Same green eyes, same tawny hair. There were a few glaring differences. I'd seen her after an automobile accident when her face was still a bit bruised and swollen. The resemblance was clear enough, though.
Hot damn.
"I got her," I said. "Hey, wow, I got her."
"Got who?"
"I don't really know yet. She calls herself Pat Usher, but she probably made that up. I'll bet you money Elaine Bolt is dead." Pat had to know that, or she never would have had the nerve to apply for a driver's license in Elaine Bolt's name. She's been living in Elaine's apartment ever since she disappeared. She's used her credit cards and probably helped herself to any bank accounts. Shit. Let's run a check on her through NCIC. Can we do that? The National Crime Information Center might well turn up identification on Pat Usher in seconds.
"Computer's down. I just tried. I'm surprised you didn't ask me to do that before."
"Jonah, I didn't have the right data before. I had a name but no numerical identifier. Now I've got a birth date. Can I have a copy of this?"
"That's yours," he said mildly. "I've got one for my files. What makes you think the birth date is legitimate?"
"I'm just crossing my fingers on that. Even if she faked a name, it'd make sense for her to use her own birth date. She might be forced to fabricate a lot of other stuff, so why falsify this? She's smart. She wouldn't work harder than she had to."
I studied the printout, turning it toward the light.
"Look at that. They marked the box that says corrective lenses. Terrific. She has to wear glasses when she drives. It's great, isn't it? Look at all the information we have. Height, weight. God, she looks tired in this picture. And look how fat she is. Check the bags underneath her eyes. Oh, boy, you should have heard her when I talked to her down there. So smug."
He'd perched himself up on the edge of the desk, and he was smiling at me, apparently amused by my excitement.
"Well, I'm glad I could help," he said. "I'm going to be out of town for a couple of days, so it's lucky that came through when it did."
For the first time, I really focused on his face. His smile was slightly fixed, and his posture had a self-conscious quality.
"You're taking some time off?" I asked.
"Well, yeah, something like that. Camilla's got a problem with one of the kids, and I thought I'd better go straighten it out. It's no big deal, but you know how it is."
I looked at him, computing backward from what he'd said. Camilla had called and snapped her fingers. He was taking off like a shot.
"The kid's my foot."
"What's going on?" I said. He gestured casually and told me some long tale about bedwetting and nightmares and visits to a child psychologist who'd recommended a session with the whole family. I said, "Uh-huh. Uh-huh," not even tuning into which girl it was. I'd forgotten what their names were. "Oh, yeah, Courtney and something."
"I'll be back on Saturday and I'll give you a buzz. Maybe we can go back up and shoot some more," he said, and smiled again.
"Great, that'd be fun," I said, smiling back. I almost suggested that he bring a blow-up of Camilla for a target, but I kept my mouth shut. I felt a tiny little moment of regret, which amazed me to no end. I hadn't even gone to bed with this man, hadn't even thought of it. Well, hardly. But I'd forgotten what it's like with married men, how married they are even when the ex is somewhere else. Especially when the ex is somewhere else. I didn't think she'd filed papers yet, which made the whole thing much simpler. He was running out of frozen dinners anyway, and by now she'd probably figured out how slim the choices were out there in singles land. I suddenly felt myself growing self-conscious, too. "Well, I better get on this. Thanks a lot. You've been a big help."
"Hey, any time," he said.
"Spillman's going to be on the desk while I'm gone if you need anything. I'll brief him so he knows the scoop, but I want you to take care of yourself." He pointed a finger at me as though it were a gun. "Don't worry about it. I don't take chances if I don't have to," I said. "I hope things work out up north. I'll talk to you when you get back."
"Absolutely. Let's do that. Good luck. Same to you. Tell the kids I said hi.
That was dumb. I'd never met them, and I couldn't think what the other one's name was in any event. Sarah?
I pushed through the gate. Hey, Kinsey?
I looked back.
Where's that hat of yours? I like that. You should wear it all the time.
I smiled and waved and went on out. I didn't need advice on how to dress. Chapter 22. It was mid-morning, and I was suddenly starving to death. I left my car in front of the police station where it was parked, and walked over to a little hole in the wall called the Egg and Eye. I ordered my standard breakfast of bacon, scrambled eggs, toast, jelly, and orange juice, with coffee throughout. It's the only meal I'm consistently fond of, as it contains every element I crave: caffeine, salt, sugar, cholesterol, and fat. How can one resist? In California, with all the health nuts around, the very act of eating such a meal is regarded as a suicide attempt. I read the paper while I ate, catching up on local events. I had just gotten down to the second piece of rye toast when Pam Sharkey walked in with Daryl Hobbs, the manager at Lambeth and Creek. She caught sight of me, and I waved. I didn't give it everything I had. It was a casual offhand wave to indicate that I was a good Joe and wasn't going to lord it over her just because I bested her last time we met. Her expression faltered, and she broke off eye contact, passing my table without a word. The snub was so pronounced that even Daryl seemed embarrassed. I was puzzled, but not cut to the quick, shrugging to myself philosophically. Maybe the aerospace engineer had turned out to be a jerk. When I finished breakfast, I paid the check and retrieved my car, popping over to the office to drop off the data I'd picked up from Jonah. I was unlocking my office door when Vera stepped out into the corridor from California Fidelity.
"Can I talk to you?" she said.
"Sure, come on in." I pushed the office door open, and she followed me in.
"How are you?" I said, thinking this was a social call.
She tucked a strand of auburn hair behind her ear, looking at me through the big, pale, blue-tinted lenses that made her eyes seem large and grave.
"Listen, just a word to the wise," she said uncomfortably. "All hell's broken loose over that Leonard Grice business."
I blinked at her. "Like what?"
"Pam Sharkey must have called him after you talked to her. I don't know what she said to him, but he's all up in arms. He's hired an attorney who fired off a letter to CFI, threatening to sue us within an inch of our lives. We're talking millions."
"For what?" "They're claiming slander, defamation of character, breach of contract, harassment."
"Andy's livid. He says he had no idea you were involved. He says you weren't authorized by California Fidelity or anybody else to go out there and ask questions. Blah, blah, blah. You know how Andy gets when he's on his high horse. He wants to see you the minute you come in."
"What is this? Leonard Grice hasn't even filed a claim."
"Guess again. He submitted forms first thing Monday morning, and he wants his money right now. The lawsuit was filed on top of that. Andy's over there processing papers as fast as he can, and he's pissed. He's told Mac he thinks we should terminate the whole arrangement with you after the jeopardy you put us in. The rest of us think he's being a complete horse's ass, but I thought you should know what's going on."
"What's the total on the claim itself?"
$25,000 for the fire damage.
"That's the face value on the homeowner's policy, and he has his losses itemized down to the penny. The life insurance isn't at issue. I think he's already collected some dinky little policy on her life, $2,500, and our records show he was paid that months ago. Kinsey, he's out for bear, and you're it. Andy's looking for someone to point a finger at so Mac doesn't point a finger at him."
"Shit," I said. I couldn't think of anything else to say.
The last thing in the world I needed right now was a dressing down by Andy Montica, the CFI claims manager. Andy's in his 40s, conservative and insecure, a man whose prime obsessions are biting his fingernails and not making waves.
"You want me to tell him you haven't come in?" she asked.
"Yeah, do that for me, if you would. Just let me check my phone messages and I'll disappear," I said. I unlocked the file and took out the folder on Elaine Bolt, looking back at Vera.
"I'll tell you something, Vera. This is hot. Leonard Grice has had 6 months to file a claim, but he hasn't lifted a finger. Now all of a sudden he's putting pressure on the insurance company to pay off? I'd like to know what prompted him."
"Hey, I gotta scoot before they come looking for me," Vera said. "Just don't cross Andy's path today, or you'll pay for it."
I thanked her for the warning and told her I'd be in touch. She eased out into the hallway again, closing the door behind her. Belatedly, I felt my cheeks flush and my heart begin to thump. I got sent down to the principal's office once in first grade for passing notes in class, and I've never recovered from the horror of it.
I was guilty as charged, but I'd never been in trouble in my life. There I was, a timid little child with skinny legs, so stricken with fear that I left the school and went home in tears. My aunt marched me right back and read everybody out while I sat on a little wooden chair in the hall and prayed for death. It's hard to keep passing myself off as a grown-up when a piece of me is still 6 years old and utterly at the mercy of authority. A glance at my answering machine showed no messages. I locked up again and went down the front way so that I could avoid passing the glass double doors of California Fidelity. I got back in my car and drove over to Elaine's old condominium. I wanted to have a brief talk with Tilly and let her know what was happening. I was turning right on Via Madrina when I glanced in the rearview mirror and realized there was some guy on a motorcycle roaring right up my tailpipe. I eased over slightly to let him pass and glanced back again. He was beeping away at me frantically. What had I done, run over his dog? I pulled over to the curb and he pulled up behind me, turning his bike off and booting his kickstand into place. He was wearing a shiny black jumpsuit, black gloves and boots, and a black helmet with a smoky face guard. I got out of my car and walked back toward him, watching him peel his helmet off as he approached. Oh, hell, it was Mike. I should have guessed. The pink of his mohawk seemed to be fading, and I wondered whether he did his touch-ups with writ dye, food coloring, or cooked beets. He was irked.
God, I've been honking at you for blocks. How come you never called me back? I left a message on your machine on Monday, he said.
Sorry, I didn't realize it was you back there. I thought you said you were going to call me.
Well, I tried to, but I kept getting your machine, so I gave up. Where were you?
Out of town. I just got back last night. Why? What's happening? He pulled his motorcycle gloves off and tucked them in his helmet, which he cradled in the crook of his arm. I think my Uncle Leonard has a girlfriend. I just thought you might like to know.
Oh, really? How'd you find out about that?
I was moving that, stash out of the shed at his old place, and I saw him go into the building next door.
The condo?
Well, yeah, I guess that's what it is. The big apartment building. When was this?
Sunday night. That's why I called you so early Monday morning. At first I wasn't sure it was him. I kind of thought it was his car pulling up out front, but it was almost dark and I couldn't see that good. I figured he was coming over to the house for something and I was shoving shit in my duffel bag like crazy. Man, I didn't know how I was going to explain what I was up to. Finally, I was in such a panic, I whipped into the shed and pulled the door shut and watched through the crack. He ended up going over there instead.
What makes you think he has a girlfriend, though?
Because I saw him with her.
I didn't have anything else to do, so I went across the street and hid behind a tree and waited until they came out. He was only in there 5 or 10 minutes, and then the lights went out, second floor left. Pretty soon they came out and shoved some stuff in the trunk and got in the car.
Did you get a good look at her?
Not really. It was hard to see him from where I was, and they were walking kind of fast. Then when they got in the car, they were all over each other. He nearly jumped her bones right there in the front seat. It was kind of weird. I mean, you usually don't see people that age making out, you know what I mean? And anyway, I never thought about him like that. I figured he was just some old dried-out fart who couldn't even get it up. I didn't think he had it in him.
Mike, the man is probably 52 years old.
Would you knock that off? What did she look like? Had you ever seen her before?
Mike held his hand up to his chin.
She came up to about here on him. I noticed that. She had her hair tied back with a scarf, like a babushka or whatever you call 'em. I don't think I'd seen her before. I mean, it wasn't like I thought, oh yeah, there's old what's-her-face or anything like that. She was just some babe.
Look, do me a favor.
Go find a pencil and paper and write all this down while it's fresh in your mind. Make a note of the date and time and anything else you remember. You don't have to say what you were doing around here. You can always claim you came over to check on the house or something. Will you do that?
Okay, sure. What are you going to do?
I haven't made that part up yet, I said. I got back in my car, and 5 minutes later I was being buzzed through the lobby to Tilly's apartment. She was waiting for me at the door, and I followed her into the living room. She was wearing a pair of spectacles low on her nose, and she peered at me over the rims. She took a seat in the rocker and picked up some needlework. It looked like a hunk of upholstery fabric printed with a scene of mountains and forest, deer grazing here and there, a stream gushing down through some rocks. She had wads of cotton, and she was shoving them into the back of the cloth with a crochet hook. The deer were puffed out into three dimensions, surrounded by stitching, to produce a quilted effect.
"What is that?" I asked, sitting down. "Are you stuffing it?"
She smiled faintly. She'd finally let her new permanent wave have its way, and her head was a nest of tight, frizzy curls the color of apricots.
"That's right, I am. It's called Trapunto.
When I finish, I'll have it blocked and framed. I do it for the church bazaar in the fall. This is cotton I save out of the tops of pill bottles, so next time you open some Tylenol or cold caps, you keep the packing for me.
End of Disc 6. Disc 7.
This is cotton I save out of the tops of pill bottles, so next time you open some Tylenol or cold caps, you keep the packing for me. Sit down. I haven't seen you for days. What have you been up to? I gave her a summary of events since Friday, which was when I had seen her last. I did some censoring. I told her how I'd found the cat, but deleted the stash of drugs Mike kept in the shed next door. I told her about Aubrey Danziger and my confrontation later with Beverly, the suitcases, the trip to Florida, the threatened lawsuit, and Mike's tale about Leonard Grice having a girlfriend upstairs. That made her take her glasses off and click the stems against the frames. I don't believe it, she said flatly. Mike must have been high. Well, of course he was high, Tilly, but a little grass isn't going to make him hallucinate. Then he's inventing it. I'm just telling you what he told me, I said. Well, who in the world could it be? I'd be willing to guarantee Leonard wasn't having an affair with any tenant of mine. And from his description, it would have been Elaine's apartment, and that's simply impossible. Oh, come on, Tilly, don't be naive. It's the perfect setup. Why couldn't he have a woman over here? Because there's no one in the building who fits that description. What about the woman in apartment 6, the one you thought might be up early the day you got your place broken into? She's 75. But you have lots of other tenants. Young married couples. Kinsey, I have more single men who'd go for Leonard than I do single women.
I'd buy that, too. What about Elaine? Why couldn't it be her?
Tilly shook her head stubbornly.
What about yourself?
Tilly laughed and patted herself on the chest. Well, I'm flattered. I'd like to believe I'm still capable of hip-grinding out on the street, but he's not exactly my type. Besides, Mike knows me. He'd have recognized me even in the dark. I conceded that one. I truly couldn't picture Tilly in a lip lock with Leonard Grice. It just didn't parse. What about Elaine? I persisted. What if she and Leonard had a thing going and decided to eliminate his wife? She does the deed while he's off at his sister's place that night. She takes off for Florida a few days later and then lays low for the next 6 months, waiting for him to get his affairs in order so they can run away together into the sunset. Once they realize I'm onto something, they step up the pace so they can blow town. Tilly stared at me for a long time. Then who is Pat Usher? I shrugged again. Maybe they enlisted her help and she's covering for them.
But who broke in here and why? I thought you were convinced Pat Usher did that.
I could feel myself getting exasperated.
I don't have all the answers, Tilly. I'm just telling you it's possible that he had some little tootsie stashed over here. Maybe it was Pat.
She didn't say a word. She just put her glasses back on and started stuffing the mountain with cotton, making it bulge like Mount St. Helens before it blew. "Can I have the key to the apartment upstairs?"
"Of course," she said. "I'll go, too."
She put down her needlework and went over to the secretary, taking a set of keys out of the drawer. She handed me a bunch of bills while she was at it, and I stuffed them in the back pocket of my jeans. It reminded me vaguely of something, but I couldn't think what. She locked her apartment, and we headed for the elevator.
You haven't heard anyone walking around overhead.
She looked back at me.
Not at all, but this place is well built, and someone could be upstairs without my hearing them. You really believe he was keeping someone up there?
It does make sense, I said. With Elaine off the scene, it's a perfect little love nest. Maybe Pat Usher found a way to get in. I'm sure she's somewhere here in town. If she had access to Elaine's place in Florida, why not this one, too?
By the way, were you here Sunday night?
She shook her head.
I was at a church social and didn't get home until shortly after 10.
The elevator door opened at the second floor, and Tilly moved down the corridor to the left, talking to me over her shoulder. She reached Elaine's front door and turned the key in the lock.
I can't believe anyone's been here, she said as we went in.
She was wrong, of course. Wim Hoover, the tenant from number 10, was sprawled in the entryway with a bullet hole just behind his right ear. The air smelled of stale cigarette smoke and the fetid perfume wafting up from his souring flesh. He'd been dead for at least 3 days. Tilly paled and went down to her place to call the police. Chapter 23.
As is my usual habit, I did a quick tour of the place while Tilly called the cops. I had cautioned her to keep my name out of it because I didn't want to have to stop and take one of Lieutenant Dolan's famous pop quizzes. I was already in trouble with California Fidelity, and I couldn't take on Dolan as well. The place smelled so foul that I didn't think Tilly would have any trouble explaining what had brought her up here to investigate. I didn't have to be Sherlock Holmes to figure out that Pat Usher had been in residence. She'd made no attempt to disguise her presence. The gauzy float I'd seen her wear in Boca Raton was now tossed carelessly across Elaine's unmade bed. She'd apparently helped herself to whatever suited her—food, clothing, cosmetics. There were dirty dishes everywhere, ashtrays filled to the brim, trash spilling out of the brown paper bag with its neatly cuffed top. The crime scene unit was going to have a ball with this place, but what interested me was the den. All the desk drawers had been opened, the contents scattered furiously, file folders ripped in half. It looked like Pat Usher's usual rage and impatience. I wondered what she'd been looking for and whether she'd found it. I didn't touch a thing. It had been maybe 5 minutes since Tilly went downstairs, and I thought I'd better scram. I didn't want to be anywhere in the neighborhood when the black and whites came screaming into view. I paused in the foyer and looked down at Wim. He was lying face down, one hand tucked under his cheek as though he meant to nap. His flesh was swollen, the skin darkening the bullet hole as tidy as the eyelet for a shoelace. The gun was probably a .22. Not a lethal weapon as a rule, but let a slug ricochet around inside a human skull, and it could turn brains into scrambled eggs in no time flat. Poor Wim. I wondered why she'd killed him. There wasn't any doubt in my mind it was Pat. Had she killed Marty Grice as well? The autopsy hadn't shown any gunshot wounds, only the repeated blows of an unidentified blunt instrument. What was the weapon, and where? I went down on the elevator and left the building without talking to Tilly again. I unlocked my car and got in, suddenly aware of the crackle of paper in my jeans pocket. I pulled out the bunch of bills Tilly had given me and let out an involuntary, "Oh." It had just dawned on me what Pat Usher might have been looking for upstairs. Elaine's passport. I had come across it myself the second time I searched the place, and I'd stuck it in the back pocket of my jeans. I couldn't remember taking it into the office, so it must be somewhere in my apartment. Had Pat broken in to look for it? If she'd found it, she was probably already on a plane headed into the great beyond. On the other hand, Leonard hadn't collected his insurance money yet, so maybe the two of them were still somewhere in town. I started the car and pulled out, determined to clear the neighborhood before the cops showed up. I was thinking hard. Pat and Leonard must have eliminated Marty first, then disposed of Elaine Bolt, maybe because she'd guessed what was going on. In any event, it must have opened up a whole new possibility. They had now gained entrance to her properties.